Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
We're going to study tonight chapter 7 of the book that we've been looking at for several weeks here, Tim Keller's book, called The Reason for God. And it's the last in his answering the objections, that is, the objections that were raised against Yeshua or against faith in God. He's going to try to answer this one tonight. And then he puts in an intermission, and then he goes on to some positive proofs for God. And we may or may not be able to go into some of those. We may just be really broad stroke on the second half of the book. So we may do a really broad stroke and look at the reasons for God without going chapter by chapter by chapter, because we each have our own reasoning that we use when we talk to people about God that we find comfortable. I'll give you some of Keller's answers later on in that. That'll be next week. But this week we're going to look at the objection called, you can't take the Bible literally, and his answers to that. Now, last week we looked at science versus the Bible, and it is one of three reasons why people don't take the Bible literally. Number one, because science has disproven it, but of course we looked at that and we're now on the side of the Bible. Number two, because it is historically inaccurate. That's the allegation. And number three, because it's culturally insensitive to those slaves and women and other issues that are raised without a hitch in the reading of the Bible. Okay? So we're going to look mostly at this historical issue. Keller talks about the difficulty that people have in reading the Bible and not knowing when to take it literally. Can we take it literally? What are some of the conventions that it breaks and some of the conventions that it holds to? When most people say that they don't take the Bible literally, what they're saying, he says, is that these stories are based on legend and not on historical data. We know from the movie with Tom Hanks and the book by Dan Brown, The Da Vinci Code, that all kinds of history was called into question by Brown. Now, I loved that book. I thought it was a great page-turner. It's terrible if you believe in history, because it makes no historical sense. And the things he alleged throughout the book were nonsensical. But hey, I wasn't reading it for history. I was reading it because it was a good book. Dan Brown's not a bestseller novelist because he's a historian, but because he's a good author. So don't get confused. The things that he alleged about the history of the Newer Testament, and especially the documents of the Newer Testament, meaning the Gospel of Thomas, you've heard about that, of late the Gospel of Judas, the Epistle of Barnabas, there are other non-canonical writings that have been brought into the conversation by the media, mostly. And so now, oh, I don't know what to believe. I don't know if I can take the Bible seriously, literally. It's so filled with legend, okay? So that's where he's going. And by the way, Daryl Bach has a couple books on the shelf back there in the objection section, the first section as you come in, which deal with the hidden gospels and deal with the dethroning of Jesus. Both of those deal with these anti-historical documents of Da Vinci and others. Well worth it if you want to study more. Daryl Bach is your man. So are they based on legends? He quotes Anne Rice, who was a famous atheist and author, the vampire author. She was raised Catholic, knocked back in her faith for so many things, and married an atheist and became the wealthy writing novel she wrote about Lestat, who's both a vampire and a rock star. You might have read them. Why she believed it was that she had disbelieved the biblical documents on the basis of all the other noises out there in the planet. In her answer, after she did her own investigation, running it against the measure of history and the way to study, Anne Rice, in her answer about the issue of the objectivity or the historicity, she said some books were no more than assumptions piled on assumptions. Conclusions were reached on the basis of little or no data at all. The whole case for the non-divine Jesus who rumbled into Jerusalem and somehow got crucified, that whole picture which had floated around the liberal circles I frequented as an atheist for 30 years, that case was not made. not only was it not made, I discovered in this field some of the worst and most biased scholarship I'd ever read. So here she was, as an atheist, reading atheistic literature about the modern, or some would call him historical Jesus. And she was scandalized. The historical Jesus, that's a term from Albert Schweitzer, turn of the 19th into 20th century. The Jewish guy Schweitzer, the famous doctor, in his famous book, In Search of the Historical Jesus. And it was that launched Jesus's popularity in a way that is not biblical. It's the Jesus of modernism, not the Jesus of the Bible. The Jesus that is a good guy and taught some good things, maybe was a radical, maybe wanted to have some followers, but he never really got what he wanted. And it was the church, the big, bad, ugly church, that made him into this deity. As Anne Rice, the atheist, reads this, she says, their stuff doesn't hold any water because it based it on its own assumptions, all circular reasoning, rather than on any data that was extant. The Christian faith requires belief in the Bible. This is a big stumbling block for many. This is what he says. Now, he's going to tackle this idea of the historicity or the non-legendary nature of the record of the Bible. We've looked at the previous chapter, we looked at science. Tonight, we're going to look at why we can trust the Bible historically. It's widely believed that the Bible is a historically unreliable collection of legends, a highly publicized forum of scholars called the Jesus Seminar. They were big in the 80s and 90s. They basically took a black highlighter, went through the Bible, and marked through and said, this can't be, this can't be, this can't be. Jesus would never, that can't be. And came up with about 20% of what Jesus said as being, yeah, he might have said that. Now, who are these guys to sort that out? 2 millennia on, that's pretty remarkable. How do we respond to this? It's beyond the range of this book to examine the historic accuracy of each part of the Bible. Instead, we'll just look at and decide whether the Gospels are reliable. And again, against the measure of the Da Vinci Code. So the first thing he tackles is that the timing is far too early to be legendary. Legends occur over time. The timing is too early for a legend. The canonical Gospels were written at the very most 40 to 60 years after the death of Yeshua, at the very latest. Legends like the legend of, name your favorite legend. He's a good one. King Arthur. How about the big Excalibur to pull that out of the rock? These are legendary tales that were never written in the time and counter-verified in the time. No, these are just story after story. Paul's letters were written just 15 to 25 years after the death of Yeshua. They provide an outline for all the events of Jesus' life found in the Gospels, his miracles, his claims, his crucifixion, and his resurrection. How do we know that it was written in the time? There were names of people who could verify what was going on. Mark chapter 15, verse 33. So Simon of Cyrene, who's allegedly a black guy, and the father of these two children, Alexander and Rufus, are inserted into the story. Simon's going to be the one who carries the cross of Yeshua because it's too heavy. Why would you stick in his kids' names? According to Keller, it's to verify, because Alexander and Rufus are still around, to verify the events that occurred. Whatever the case, these were real people who were alive at the time, because if you want to counter a legend, all you have to have is witnesses who say, what are you talking about? We were there with Kevin Rudd. What are you talking about? I was there when Sir Donald threw the ball and spat the dummy. I knew what happened. You know, when you've got real witnesses, you can't make up the story. That's counter legend. So the timing's too early. 1 Corinthians 15, 1-6, this is long. So his second appeal here is to the 500 who some are still alive. You would never do that if you're writing a legend to Cephas, Peter, and the 12, the apostles, some of whom were still alive when Paul is writing this letter, and to the 500, some of whom have died. Okay, fair enough. But this is 25 years after the death of Yeshua. Some of the 500 are still around, putting their hands up, saying, yep, I was there. He appeared to me. I'm still around. I can testify. You can't write this that he just read, what the gospel is, that Yeshua died for our sins, rose from the dead. You can't write that for public reading unless there's testimony that's agreed and confirmable not only Yeshua's supporters who were still alive as well in this legendary consideration. There were opponents who were still alive, or people who didn't exactly cheer him on. And they would have been especially ready to challenge any accounts that were fabricated. The Gospels were written far too soon for any kind of legendary action to take place. It would have been impossible then for the new faith to spread as it did had Yeshua never said or done the things mentioned in the Gospel accounts. Acts 26:26. He's telling King Agrippa here, this is the Apostle Paul, telling King Agrippa, these things were not done in secret, not done in a corner. We weren't doing them in dark. You guys saw it. You were there's evidence out there. And Agrippa, you're the king, for goodness sakes. You could rewrite history if you wanted, but this is public information. So I think his point is well taken, that it is out there. The four canonical Gospels were written much earlier than the so-called Gnostic Gospels anyway. You know, the Gnostic, the Judas and I want to write Agrippa. And Thomas and Judas. These Gospels were written in the 2nd century, 170, 175, 190, way late in the game, long after they'd already been canonized. The word canon is a word that means ruler, like straight edge, like a plumb line when you're hanging wallpaper. So the canon of Scripture means the straight edge, meaning you can count on it being a rule that is going to give you stability and it's going to be right. It's not something that flutters and fluctuates. It's not something that might be right today and might not be right tomorrow. It's true and ever was and ever will be. The Word of God is something on which you can count. So they canonized the Older Testament a few hundred years before Yeshua, and the Older Testament and the Newer Testament by the middle of the 2nd century. So it was already complete. Certainly the Gospels were, and the four and only four were already fixed before Thomas and Judas and anybody else put up their hand to write a story. Of course, Judas and Thomas were long gone. So the Gospels were already done. So this widespread idea that the Da Vinci Code and Dan Brown brings us, that the Catholic Church and Constantine in the 4th century erased the stuff that was not fitting to their style of life and put in their own versions, just nonsense. Second issue tonight, the content is too counterproductive. You would never have certain content if you were writing a non-trustworthy literary epic. If you're writing the Iliad, if you're writing Gladiator, if you're writing something to show off your guy as the guy, you're not going to write the way the New Testament authors wrote about Yeshua and especially about the disciples. You're going to show yourself in a whole different light. You're going to show your guy is much better, is a whole different thing. So we're going to look at some of these. You're going to actually take sides. You remember Josephus. Some of you have read about the historian Josephus. And he's a good author and a good historian that most Jewish people and most history people really like. But whenever they get to an issue where it comes close to the church, the Jewish Josephus is tainted because he's writing under the auspices of and the bright shining light of Rome. And he has to, write down, I'll write that in there, how Rome is a good place. So his history is tainted. And you would expect that in a non-historical, non-trustworthy document. The biblical writers didn't do that at all. Keller talks about, you would never write your guy was a criminal. Jesus dying on a cross? He's a weak mamby-pamby guy. And did you hear him in the garden when he said, oh, daddy, take this cup from me. It's too hard. Sounds like a teenager. Sounds like an 8-year-old being told to take the rubbish out on trash night. You'd never write the guy in your epic, would you, like that? The gospel writers put Yeshua in for exactly who he was. When he's on the cross, they might have concluded that he was certainly an offensive guy to the powers that be. They would have concluded he was weak and he failed his God. They assigned him a low status. You'd never write your main guy of your Iliad, of your Superman series. You'd never write him in like that. The only plausible reason that all these episodes would be included is that they actually happen. Also, why constantly depict the apostles, the eventual leaders of the early church, as petty and jealous? Mark 14:71. Peter, at the crucifixion, at the arrest of Messiah, when Jesus needs his friends the most, Peter, the eventual macher of the whole new church, you'd think Peter would say, I'll stand with you, Messiah. Here we go. Let's go. Let's beat up the bad guys. Instead, they write him in, and Mark is a disciple of Peter. Some say he's the son of Peter, John Mark. Some just say he's a disciple. So Mark, who's writing this text, puts in daddy or daddy in the faith as some wimpy guy who now acts more like the world than the world, cursing and swear, I don't know the guy, walking away. It's going to cost me too much. You'd never write the mocker as some wimp if you're writing a historically inaccurate piece. You'd want to make him look good. Why would anyone in the early church want to play up the terrible failures of their most prominent leaders? Again, a comparison with the Gnostic Gospels is illuminating. Gnostic gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge. The Latin word for knowledge, science. So the Gnostics were people who believed that there were secret information hidden. And if you could just get that hidden information and those magical societies are formed, and if I could just join that mob and learn the secret handshake or the secret prayers or the secret chants or whatever, then I would go up a notch and get towards the enlightened world. They didn't use enlightenment like they did later on in the European 18th century, but it's similar. And the Gnostic Gospels were written with gnosis in mind, and they are the Gospel of Thomas and Judas, etc. And he says here that Gnosticism, a philosophy called Gnosticism, in which the material world is a dark, evil place, that's also true, from which our spirits need to be rescued by secret illumination, or gnosis. This fits in very well with the worldview of the Greeks and Romans, but it's utterly different than that of the first century Jewish people in which Jesus was a part. Contrary then to the Da Vinci Code and similar accounts, it's not the canonical gospels that suck up to the powers that be in the ancient world, but it's the Gnostic ones that do. Keller's a thinker. Isn't he good? I really like him. The canonical gospels not only give us a more accurate, credible picture of what the original Jesus was really like, but they boldly challenge the worldview of their Greek and Roman readers. It is too good. All right. Number three in his literacy. The literary form is too detailed to be unhistorical. Now, here's the problem for us. We read novels by Dan Brown or Bryce Courtney, let's be Aussie, or anybody we want. We read these novels, and they're filled with details. And they walk down the street on the Thursday, and they stopped at the corner just before the yellow light in front of Magruder's Bakery. But ancient novels were not written with such precision and detail. Ancient novels were much wider, less detailed. The Gospels themselves are written with precision and detail that goes counter to the very idea of old-style novels. So they're either written by a very clever modern who stuck minus 30 AD at the bottom of his signature, or it's not a novel of the first century type. The literary form is too detailed, and we're going to look at just a few of those. In Mark chapter 4, we're told that Yeshua was asleep on the cushion in the stern of a boat. Way too much detail. They'd never do that. He would have been in the boat, and a wind came, and he stood. That's how the old days would have been written. In John 21, we're told that Peter was 100 yards out in the water when he saw Yeshua on the beach. He would have been in a boat in old writing. And then, together, after Peter jumped out of the boat, this is after the resurrection, how many fish did he catch? 150-something. 153. You know, it's one of those things you look at, why'd they write that in there? Precision. Too detailed to be a literary form to be dismissed. It's put in to verify and counter-verify and keep verifying the historicity of this book so that all the other things that you can't verify, that he's the Son of God, that he's sinless, that he died for your sins. We know he dies, but for your sin. So that you take all the rest of it on board, because he's given us enough detailed proof to show that it is historical. Does that make sense? 153 fish. I just found that fascinating.
Did they count it?
That's what I want to know. Who counted the fish? His third issue, which we're not going to deal with tonight. The first issue in taking the Bible literally is the science issue. We dealt with that last week. Second issue is that the Bible is historically inaccurate. And the third is that it's culturally insensitive. And Keller's argument boils down to one thing in this third of the three legs of knocking back the taking the scriptures literally. When we read in the Bible, slaves, obey your masters. What would a modern anti-slavery person say? You're a human. You've got two legs. Stand on them. Challenge those guys. What would he say about believers and their views on slavery or the Bible speaking about slavery?
But the Bible condones slavery.
Does it condone slavery the way we know slavery? See, that's the problem. We project 1850 black slaves coming from Africa into America on a slave ship where they're bound, have no rights. They're in the basement, you know, the lowest rungs, and they have no rights, and they have no privileges. That's not the biblical way of looking at slaves. Slaves in Roman days, specifically, were dressed about the same as free men, earned wages, maybe not as much as, but earned wages, and could actually buy their own freedoms. You'd never get a black African-American slave, 1850, to buy his, that just didn't happen. So the problem with cultural, I want to use a word, uniformitarianism, the problem with saying culture today is the same as it always was, is to dismiss history and the changes within language and the changes within society. So when the apostle writes, slaves obey your masters, he's talking about a Roman slave, and he's also not dealing with the issue of slavery itself. He's not saying, since I condone slavery, you little guys there, ha, gotcha. In fact, if you read the letter to Philemon, it's a short book, one chapter in the Newer Testament. It's the story of Philemon and Onesimus, the slave and slave owner, and how Paul writes to the slave owner and says, you owe me your life because I led you to Messiah. Now you take back your slave, but treat him like a brother. He's no longer to be just some under your thumb guy. If anything speaks of Paul's view on slavery, it would be the letter of Philemon, a tremendous text. So all that to say, we can't argue from a cultural uniformitarianism from the past to today, from today back to the past. We have to let every culture speak of itself. Women, how would you answer the Bible is anti-women? John chapter 4, Yeshua spoke to the woman at the well, and they, the disciples, when they came back, what are you doing talking to a woman? Because he broke social barriers. How about the people he selected to be his first emissaries? Women. He sent that woman at the well back to the town to preach, and she preached, and the whole town of Samaria came out to hear Yeshua. And they said, now we believe it, not because we heard her tell us, but for we've heard for ourselves and believe you're the Messiah. That is awesome. And after he rose from the dead and Mary's clutching at his feet, he says, stop clinging to me, but go to my brothers and tell them. He chose women. You would never send women. They had no social rank. He elevated women highly. So yeah, I wouldn't take it from a cultural way that Yeshua had a disregard. If anything, he had a high regard for women and included them in his Passover and included them, whether he's challenging or chiding Martha about what she's doing, but letting Mary hang by his feet. You know, the word Messiah means what? Anointed. In the Greek, what's the word? Christos. Same thing. And that means anointed one. Now, we know that kings were anointed in the Bible and priests and prophets. And Yeshua is called the Messiah, the anointed one. So, when was he anointed?
Mary Magdalene.
She poured oil on his feet. That's the only time he was ever anointed, and it was by a woman. So, this whole idea of cultural supremacy and the disregard of slaves and women, I think, is unbiblical. And all of that to say, and to agree along with Tim Keller, that if people are open-minded and people of goodwill, that all the objections they might raise against the Bible, against God, against Jesus, against whatever that we stand for, all of those objections are answerable, and a person of goodwill will hear them.
In regards to the Old Testament and poetry being never used,
Keller doesn't go into it. He says time doesn't allow him to go through the whole of the Bible and subjugate everything to his examination. But I would say the number one issue in Torah related to the equality of women is the daughters of Zelophehad. Zelophehad. They were women without brothers, and their daddy was old, and who gets the land? So they go to Moses. Moses goes to God. God says, give it to the chicks. I don't know if that's exactly what he said. Because the women had equal value and standing with the rest of the tribes, rest of the brothers. And that's huge and important to see. I'd say that's the pivotal moment in the Older Testament related to that.
We have female rabbis.
And people 150 years ago would be scandalized. And there are some guys today who are scandalized because a woman should never be a rabbi. And the number one argument was not a leadership quality issue, but a literally stained issue. That is, she might be on her period. And the bima, the platform on which everything happened, might be literally stained. And then a man might step on it. You get the idea. So it was a physical tarnishing.
But it's funny because that's not taken into the reform sort of way of being, so they didn't look at that.
Exactly. Yeah, they would say, well, that's science, and we've cleaned up the act, and now a woman, even on her period, is not dirty. She's not unclean. Therefore, it's not a problem. Yeah, the reform started about the middle of the 18th century and canonized, if you will, their own doctrines in the end of the 19th century. Would have no problem, and that's why there are reform rabbis. And even conservative now, the middle ground Jewish world, there's some conservative Jewish women and Jewish cantors. Orthodox, I don't think that'll ever happen. I've been wrong before, but I don't think that'll ever happen.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.